And as they head down, I'm going to invite the newly crowned Powerhouse Game Night Dartboard Champion, Dave Stafke, to come front with me here. The dartboard was the thing the other night, by the way, and the coloring.
You ain't the real champ yet.
Dave defeated me in a highly competitive, intense competition in the championship game. I'm not bitter, though, Dave. You deserved it. You did well. So, but darts are not the reason that I have invited Dave up here with me today. The reason is that when we were there the other night, I noticed that Dave had a pretty nasty reaction to some laundry detergent. He told me what had happened. OxyClean, to be specific. And Dave, show if we can still see. We've got some good reaction there. I'm sure you can't see it in the back row, but kind of painful. And so I just really felt that it was important for me, Dave, as your pastor, to examine your rash up front here today. So I'd like to take a closer look here. Let's turn that over. Yeah, you see that right there? See how the hair has turned white?
No.
In that little spot?
It seems
the infection seems to be a little bit beneath the skin. That's what I was afraid of. You have an infectious skin disease, my friend.
Leprosy?
And it's not leprosy, but I do have to tell you that I am going to need you to immediately leave the building. And not only that, I need you to actually leave Madison. You can go out on foot into the fields. Actually, the deacons are prepared for this. They'll give you some warm clothes and a tent as you head out. And when you get out there, what I'd like you to do is tear the clothes that you're wearing. You know, over the weeks, if you could kind of let your hair just become unkempt, make it look like you're mourning. Go a little ragged. There's going to be a scarf type thing in that package of clothes. If you could just kind of wear it over the bottom of your face like that. And if by any chance someone would approach you out in the fields, I before they get close, yell to them, "Unclean! Unclean!"
Okay.
Okay?
I got you.
Now, if your rash goes away, find someone to come tell. Don't come tell me yourself. Find someone.
I'll go find someone.
To come tell me, and I will go out to you and examine you and see if we can bring you back in the city. Okay, do you understand?
Okay, I got you.
Okay, be gone with you. Thank you, Dave. Thank you. You can stay, Dave. Yeah, okay. And, you know, even though everyone knows that I'm just kidding, everyone's going to hesitate when they try to shake your hand today. It's unclean. Unclean. All this stuff sounds strange, doesn't it? You know, one of the challenges in reading the Old Testament is we have to some extent anyway, set aside our cultural mindset, our understanding of the world, and try to get into the heads of people who lived 3,500 years ago. Do you think that people who lived 3,500 years ago had a little bit different understanding on how the world worked? I think that if I could jump into a time machine and blast back to the era of Leviticus, that in the course of my conversations with whoever I find there, if I talked about infectious skin diseases and how to diagnose them, how to handle them in the same way I just talked to Dave, I'll bet it wouldn't seem that strange to them. And if I did start talking to them about how that there's this antibiotic ointment and how antibiotics are used to treat diseases, that's when they'd start saying that I was crazy, right? So we are talking about very different understandings of the world between where we're at now and where the people were at that we'll be reading about this morning. So we're in the middle of a sermon series that's revolving around this question: what exactly is Old Testament law and why does it matter? What exactly is Old Testament law and why does it matter? We've already looked at the Ten Commandments. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Old Testament sacrificial law. Today, we look at holiness laws, sometimes called purity laws. What was considered clean, what was considered unclean in Old Testament Israel? Oh, Wow, you contained your excitement quite well there. I was sure that I was going to get some cheering when I announced that topic. You know, yes, purity laws, Old Testament purity laws. I'm surprised. I think you'll discover that there are some very interesting things to think about as we go through this subject together this morning. And we will discuss why Old Testament purity laws are, why they matter. And we'll do that because that's our sermon title topic. What is it? Why does it matter? So here we go. First half of that sermon series topic question is, what exactly is Old Testament law? What is it? So let's look at some of these laws that God gave the Israelites through Moses about religious cleanliness. They tend to fall into three main categories: what not to eat, what not to touch, and infections. So here is the first category, what not to eat. We'll go to Leviticus chapter 11. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, say to the Israelites, of all the animals that live on the land, these are the ones you may eat. You may eat any animal that has a divided hoof. Here is a divided hoof. Okay? You may eat any animal that has a divided hoof and choose the cud. And next slide is a little cud chewer for you. There are some that only chew the cud or only have a divided hoof, but you must not eat them. The camel, though it chews the cud, does not have a divided hoof. It is ceremonially unclean for you to eat. The hyrax, or rock badger, though it chews the cud, does not have a divided hoof. It is unclean for you. The rabbit, though it chews the cud, does not have a divided hoof. It's unclean for you. And the pig, though it does have a divided hoof, does not chew the cud. Therefore, it is unclean for you. You must not eat their meat or touch their carcasses. They are unclean for you. Of all the creatures living in the water, the seas, and the streams, you may eat any that have fins and scales. But all creatures in the seas or streams that do not have fins and scales, whether among all the swarming things or among all the other living creatures in the water, you are to regard as unclean. And the chapter goes on, of course, to list many birds, insects, other animals that they can eat, and those that are unclean. I have a slide for you here that will use the principles of Leviticus 11, but kind of bring it into maybe some more modern or animals we're familiar with. So among the mammals, yes, you could eat bulls, cows, sheep, goats. No, as we saw, you can't eat camels, rabbits, or pigs. Among sea creatures, yes to tuna, salmon, herring, etc. No to shrimp, crab, and lobsters. Yes, and the birds to goose, duck, chicken, turkey. No to eagle, vulture, raven, owl, bats, and those kinds of things. Okay, so these are, so stop eating bats. So these are just a few examples. Of course, the list could go on quite long. Next, we learn that even the clean animals, if they were not eaten in the proper way, would be unclean for the Israelites. We'll skip to verse 39. If an animal that you are allowed to eat dies, anyone who touches its carcass will be unclean till evening. Anyone who eats some of its carcass must wash their clothes, and they will be unclean till evening. And part of this ties into strict guidelines that the Lord gave to the Israelites about not eating blood. All right, so here's another thing not to eat is blood. Look at Deuteronomy 12. You may slaughter your animals in any of your towns and eat as much of the meat as you want according to the blessing the Lord your God gives you, but you must not eat the blood poured out on the ground like water. Be sure you do not eat the blood, because the blood is the life. And you must not eat the life with the meat. You must eat the blood poured out on the ground like water. So there's respect shown for life here. There's respect the lifeblood in this rule to not eat blood. Some scholars wonder if perhaps there were some people groups nearby in those days who were trying to eat blood, drink blood in order to obtain more life force, that kind of thing. And maybe this was wrapped up in the worship of false gods, and so that might have had something to do with this prohibition as well. But in any case, clean animals only remain clean if they were slaughtered in the right way with all the blood being poured out onto the ground. So if you just ran into a random carcass sitting somewhere, you couldn't guarantee that that had been done correctly, so now it's unclean for you. And look then at the summary words of this section on what not to eat found at the end of Leviticus 11. Do not defile yourselves by any of these unclean creatures. Do not make yourselves unclean by means of them or be made unclean by them. I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves and be holy because I am holy. You must distinguish between the unclean and the clean, between living creatures that may be eaten and those that may not. What to eat, what not to eat, that's our first category of holiness laws. What is all this holiness stuff, by the way? Before we get to our second category, let's just pause on that question quick. What does this command for the Israelites to be holy mean? Definition of holiness, according to Nelson's Bible Dictionary, is moral and ethical wholeness and perfection. It represents freedom from all moral evil. Something that is holy is set apart for divine purpose. I'm going to repeat that for you. There's a lot of things going on there. Definition of holiness, moral and ethical wholeness or perfection. It represents freedom from moral evil. Something that is holy is set apart for divine purpose. And that Bible dictionary goes on to say that God's nature is holiness. God is, of course, completely free from moral evil. He is perfect. He is holy. When God came to the Israelites and told them that he was going to dwell with them in a special way, this declaration carried with it some extremely sobering consequences for them. The covenant that God set up with Israel through Moses brought many incredible promises of what God would do for them. But it also carried an obligation for the Israelites, their part of the deal. And their part of the deal was to obey me fully. Completely. They were to be perfect. Just as God is perfect. We've seen over and over again the Bible teaching that God cannot be with sin, right? And sin carries with it the death penalty. So God cannot be with sin, so therefore if he's going to come and live in the Israelite camp, they were going to need to be holy too. Otherwise he can't be with them. It wasn't going to work. Problem, of course, is that we know people can't be completely holy. So thus the Old Testament sacrificial system that we looked at 2 weeks ago, where they could sacrifice animals that would provide temporary forgiveness of sins, a measure of holiness. But it's a dangerous and difficult thing for sinners to live with a holy God. Look at Exodus 19 here. God said to the Israelites, "If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." So not only would the Israelites have priests within their nation, those who were mediators between God and the average Israelite, but the whole nation of Israel would function in that role of priest for the rest of the world. God was going to live within Israel. They would become now the go-betweens between the priests mediating between God and all other nations. They needed to be holy, set apart, different from other people groups. They needed to be perfect, somehow free from evil in order to accomplish their divine purpose. So we've already seen and we'll continue to see as we go through these purity laws today, this call for Israel to be holy. These cleanliness laws were part of the holiness system that God was setting up in Israel. That's why we call them holiness laws. Okay, let's move on now to that second category of holiness laws. We saw what not to eat, now we're going to look at what not to touch. Well, we talked about carcasses already. The carcass of a dead animal, whether it was clean or unclean, is not to be touched. The person who touches it will be considered unclean. And it goes much further than that, back to Leviticus 11. If one of the unclean animals dies and falls on something, that article, whatever its use, will be unclean, whether it's made of wood, cloth, hide, or sackcloth. Put it in water, it'll be unclean until evening, and then it'll be clean. If one of them falls into a clay pot, everything in it will be unclean, and you must break the pot. Any food you are allowed to eat that has come into contact with water from any such pot is unclean. Any liquid that's drunk from such a pot is unclean. Anything that one of their carcasses falls on becomes unclean. An oven or cooking pot must be broken up. So pretty detailed. Don't touch carcasses. Don't touch anything that has touched a carcass. Don't touch anything that has touched something that has touched a carcass. Do we see why the Day of Atonement was such an important thing then for the Israelites? That was the day where the priest achieved forgiveness for all the sins the Israelites committed that they didn't know about. It's kind of hard to know if you have touched something that has touched something that has touched something that has touched a carcass. So they were covered by the Day of Atonement. Similar idea in Leviticus 15, except now we're talking about something that is or not touching something that has touched a person who has become unclean, Leviticus 15. Any bed the unclean man lies on will be unclean. Anything he sits on will be unclean. Anyone who touches his bed must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they'll be unclean till evening. Whoever sits on anything that the man sat on must wash their clothes and bathe with water. They'll be unclean till evening. Whoever touches the man must wash their clothes, bathe with water. They'll be unclean till evening. A clay pot that the man touches must be broken. Any wooden article is to be rinsed with water. All right, so these are things not to touch. The second category of staying ceremonially clean and holy in Israel. On to the third category of holiness laws. Infections. Poor Dave fell into this one today. Leviticus 13. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, when anyone has a swelling or a rash or a shiny spot on their skin that may be a defiling skin disease, they must be brought to Aaron the priest or to one of his sons who is a priest. The priest is to examine the sore on the skin, and if the hair in the sore has turned white and the sore appears to be more than skin deep, it is a defiling skin disease. When the priest examines that person, he shall pronounce them ceremonially unclean. If the shiny spot on the skin is white but does not appear to be more than skin deep and the hair has not turned white, the priest is to isolate the affected person for 7 days. On the seventh day, the priest is to examine them. If the sore has faded and has not spread, the priest shall pronounce them clean. It's only a rash. They must wash their clothes and they'll be clean. Boy, you know, God meets with people where they're at. He does not say to them, if you have a defiling skin disease, I want you to know that 3,500 years from now, there will be something called antibiotic ointment that would be really helpful for you. All right? He is working with them in their cultural context. This is where they were at. The priest would be the one to make the determination whether this was serious and infectious or not. Or if it was not serious. If he deemed it to be infectious, he would get that person away from the rest of the people, so that the rest of Israel would not become infected. 3,500 years ago. And by the way, aren't you glad that I am your pastor and not your pastor/doctor? Verse 45. Anyone with such a defiling disease must wear torn clothes, Dave Stafke. Let their hair become unkempt. Cover the lower part of their face and cry out, unclean, unclean. As long as they have the disease, they remain unclean. They must live alone. They must live outside the camp. Okay, this law wasn't just about keeping the infection from spreading, though. Okay, it was also about maintaining holiness within Israel. Look at Numbers chapter 5. The Lord said to Moses, command the Israelites to send away from the camp anyone who has a defiling skin disease or a discharge of any kind, who's ceremonially unclean because of a dead body, for instance. Send away male and female alike. Send them outside the camp so they will not defile their camp where I dwell among them. The Israelites did so. They sent them outside the camp just as the Lord had instructed. So 3,500 years ago, people did not have the strong sense of distinction between soul and body that we have today. Physical imperfections were considered to be on par with moral imperfections. So interestingly, some of these people that get removed from the camp because of a physical infection, the remedy for them later on, if it's healed, is to come and offer a sin offering. So sin, infection is sin. As you go through the Bible later on, you'll start to see more of a distinction made between physical afflictions and moral sin. But it's a bit blurry here. Holiness equals wholeness and perfection. We saw that in the definition. Wholeness and perfection. The Israelites were supposed to be holy because the holy God dwelt in their camp. Perfection was in their camp. Imperfection was not allowed. So you have all kinds of regulations in Leviticus 12 through 15 against infections, even against mildew growing in houses or touching blood coming out of people. And these diseases symbolize sin and imperfection. Okay, so there's your three categories of holiness laws in Old Testament Israel. There actually is a fourth. It involves the regulations for the priests. As you can imagine, since the priests were the mediators between God and the rest of the Israelites, they had even stricter laws about how to stay ceremonially clean. But we don't have time to go into those laws today. So what happened to people in Israel when they became unclean? It appears that some people were destined to live their lives outside of the camp, unless their infection healed. If you combined ceremonial uncleanliness with straight-out disobedience, it could be even worse for you. You could get banned from all of Israel permanently. This is Leviticus 7. Anyone who touches something unclean, whether human uncleanness or an unclean animal or unclean creature that moves along the ground, and then eats any of the meat of the fellowship offering belonging to the Lord at the tabernacle, they must be cut off from their people. And there are other examples to be found of that too, where uncleanness was combined with sin, and it led to someone needing to be cut off from Israel. But for most situations, cleanliness was restored in short order. We already have seen a number of phrases say you're unclean until the sun goes down, until evening, and then you're clean again. For more serious situations, like someone who had a problem like Dave's, sorry, Dave, but they got better, then the scenario would go something like this from Leviticus 14. There would be a sacrifice of a bird, and then the person to be cleansed must wash their clothes, shave off all their hair, and bathe with water. They'll be ceremonially clean then. After this, they may come into the camp, but they must stay outside their tent for 7 days. On the seventh day, they must shave off all their hair, they must wash their clothes and bathe themselves with water, and they'll be clean. On the eighth day, they must bring 2 male lambs and 1 ewe lamb a year old, each without defect, and they offer these as guilt offerings, and this then makes atonement for the one to be cleansed from their uncleanliness. Oh, how are we to make sense of all this stuff? There are some that argue that the cleanliness laws, especially the food laws, were given to the Israelites for health reasons. I'm sure you've heard that. Listen to contemporary Jewish author Tracy Rich's comments on that idea. There is no question, she says, that some of the dietary laws have beneficial health effects. However, many of the laws have no known connection with health. To the best of our modern scientific knowledge, there's no reason why camel or rabbit meat is any less healthy than cow or goat meat. The short answer to why Jews observe these laws is because the Torah, God's law, says so. The Torah does not specify any reason, and for a Torah-observant traditional Jew, there is no need for any other reason. We show our obedience to God by following these laws, even though we don't know the reason. So the reason to follow these laws, she says here, is because God said so. And certainly that is reason enough, isn't it? But don't you still want to know why? I do, especially when usually it's so easy to see the reasoning behind God's principles in his teaching. So why would God pile onto the Israelites all of these detailed laws about cleanliness, some of which we can't see a reason for? Well, Tracy Rich has a further thought on that. She goes on to say this: when properly observed, following all the details of Old Testament law increases the spirituality in a person's life because it turns the most trivial, mundane acts, such as eating, getting dressed, into acts of religious significance. When you do these things, you're constantly reminded of your relationship with the divine, and it becomes an integral part of your entire existence. The simple act of eating turns into a religious ritual. A Jew who observes the Old Testament food laws cannot eat a meal without being reminded of the fact that he is a Jew. Well, that's interesting. Maybe this is a reason behind the enactment of so many detailed and hard to understand commands here. Maybe these laws were put in place just to deeply involve God in every area of daily life for the Israelite, so they were constantly aware of him. It's an interesting thought. We'll come back to that a little bit in a moment. Okay, so what exactly is Old Testament law? This has been a pretty good look at Old Testament purity laws today. So next, why does it matter? Why do Old Testament purity laws matter to us today? Are we supposed to follow them? Well, we've covered that in past sermons, and I've told you that I believe the Bible teaches that Gentile followers of Jesus, like we all are here, are not bound to follow the cleanliness laws. These laws are part of that old covenant that God made with Israel. So if we're not bound to follow them, then why do they matter? I'm going to take a cue from Jesus on this one. We've seen in the past that Jesus taught that the spirit of the law was of greater importance than the letter of the law. So this might be a good question for us to ask at this point. What was the spirit behind these laws of purity and holiness in Israel? What was God trying to teach through the implementation of these laws? Here's some ideas for you. First idea. I think these holiness laws taught that obedience to God was very important. I would say that's something you can take away from looking at these laws and especially the consequences for not obeying them that were built in. These laws show that being separated from God, being kicked out of the camp, it's a bad thing to be separated from God. They teach that. What if God had not spent time through these and other Old Testament laws communicating just how serious it was to have sin in your life, how serious it was to be separated from Him? What if God had gone right to the grace system that we're in right now? If He had done that, would anyone understand what an absolutely huge deal His grace is for us? If He had not strictly taught the seriousness of sin for a while? So I believe that the holiness law has taught that obedience to God is vitally important. Second idea of what God might have been trying to teach through these holiness laws. I believe these laws teach the importance of a relationship with God. And this was triggered by that comment from Tracy Rich. Through the purity laws, especially the food laws there, through the Old Testament sacrificial laws, through the laws about Sabbath keeping and festival observance, God intertwined Himself into every aspect of Jewish life. If you were an Israelite back then, you could not go through a single day without thinking about God multiple times. Do we go through the day without thinking about God sometimes? Do we get through the whole day? Wouldn't have happened back then. And I think these laws show the importance God places upon us having an intimate and an involved relationship with Him. Relationship with God should be a human being's top priority. I think this is involved here in what He's teaching. Third idea, I believe these laws demonstrate that those in this world who follow God should look different, should act different than those in this world who don't. God wanted His people Israel to be different, to be set apart, to be holy. And that was not only accomplished through these holiness laws. Don't forget that all of Old Testament law rested on the foundation of that great moral code of the Ten Commandments. Again and again in Leviticus and elsewhere, the Israelites were reminded that they should not behave in the detestable ways of the people groups around them. They were to be moral. They were to be different. They were to be holy. And that is not any different for us here today, those who follow God. People should be able to tell that we are Christian. Fourth and final idea. I think these laws teach that God is perfect, and that if you want to have open fellowship with God, you have to be perfect too. I think they teach that. And in this final idea, then, we see the same scenario playing out as we did in our look at Old Testament sacrificial law. These laws point to the human need for Jesus Christ. How tiring it must have been to live in Old Testament Israel, constantly trying to measure up to perfection, trying to obey all the laws, don't eat, don't touch, don't get sick. But I think that was part of the point, wasn't it? We need a Savior. We can't be perfect. Hebrews 10, and we looked at this one in the last sermon too. Day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never fully take away sins. But when this priest, Jesus Christ, had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. And here's the key verse. For by his one sacrifice, he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Okay, so there's two things that happen when we turn our lives over to Christ and make him Lord. And you see them both in that verse. One is we begin to be made holy, as it says there. It's a process. God works in us over time to accomplish it. But also, at that moment of making Jesus your Lord, we are, it says it right there, we are made, what? Perfect. We're made perfect instantly. In God's eyes, we can't be any more perfect than we are. We are perfect as He is perfect. Well, that is certainly a miracle. There's no way we could have ever done that by ourselves or even gotten close. It's only through God's gift to us through Jesus that this is possible. We can be made clean forever. We can't become unclean anymore. Made holy as God is holy. Perfection, because the holy blood of Jesus was spilled for us. That's amazing grace. Amazing grace it is. And because God has made all of us perfect, even while we're still sinners, then we want to start obeying and to be less sinful, right? We want to respond to him in love through our obedience. Colossians 3 says, "Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience." We're already holy, it says there. We're God's new chosen people, the church, already made holy. So then, he says, start acting holy. Be compassionate, be kind, be humble, be gentle, be patient. Live it out, what you already are. The standard isn't any different in the New Testament than the Old Testament, is it? We still are required to be perfect, just as they were, if we want fellowship with God. It's just that God has given us a way to become perfect. It has nothing to do with us. It's a gift. We can be holy because he makes us holy. So why should all these purity laws in the Old Testament matter to us today? I believe when we step back and we look at them and we ask what's the spirit behind them, we discover that God was teaching through them some very foundational concepts about who he was and about the relationship between him and human beings. Foundational concepts that have strongly affected our understanding of God today, probably much more than we even realize. Let's recap them. He taught through these laws that it's vitally important to obey God, that our personal relationship with God is hugely important. It should impact the details of our daily lives. That if we call ourselves God followers, we ought to look and behave quite different than those in the world who are not following God. And four, we learn through these laws that God is perfect, and if we want to be with him, we need to be perfect too. Praise God for what he has done for us through Jesus Christ. A last thought for you as we head to the conclusion here. These purity laws were set up quite early in God's fairly early in God's interaction with humanity, and it was an early stage of this unfolding plan of salvation that he was bringing to the world. He clearly was working with these ancient people in their cultural context. There are so many things in these passages that look crazy to us, but would not have looked so crazy to the people back then. Just like with animal sacrifice, God took patterns of thought and behavior that were common in that day, and he used those things to teach new spiritual truths. When Jesus came onto the scene, God was a lot further along in teaching his program to the world and unfolding his plan. We're told in the New Testament by Jesus that if you want to know the Father, look at the Son. We can see God's true character through Jesus. You know what I see when I look at the Son? I see a man who didn't run away from people with skin diseases because he was afraid they might touch him and make him unclean. But instead, in Jesus, I see a man who reached out to touch people who had skin diseases. I see a man who didn't banish those with imperfections outside the camp, but instead in Jesus I see a man who wanted to sit down to dinner with imperfect people, with outcasts and sinners. I see a man who wanted to know them and to teach them and to heal them. Jairus' daughter was dead, you know, in Luke chapter 8 says, good Israelites are not supposed to touch corpses, or they become unclean. But Jesus reached out his hand and grabbed hers, and then he brought life back to her. So this is the true character. Don't get confused with the Old Testament laws. This is the true character of our God. So there may have been days in the past, in the unfolding of God's program, where an allergic reaction to OxyClean might have got you kicked out of the camp. But we know now, through Jesus, that all people, no matter their health status, no matter their diet, no matter what they might have touched during the day, all people, no matter their race, their income level, how talented they are, all people, whether Jew or Gentile, are invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb. invited to be made perfect and holy by a loving and merciful God, invited to have fellowship with him here and now, and then be brought into complete wholeness and perfection with him in heaven after we die. All people are invited to this. You can be made permanently clean by the blood of the sacrificial lamb, Jesus. All you have to do is accept the invitation. It's hard reading, Leviticus. You have to set aside your modern understanding of the world, try to get into the brains of people that lived many, many years ago. It's hard to understand some of these ancient ways of thinking, some of these Old Testament laws, but God was working through these things. He was teaching lessons to the world through his kingdom of priests, the Israelites, lessons that still apply to those of us today who seek to follow God. So this is Old Testament law, and this is why it matters.